Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporation, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 27, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on our Supreme Court bankruptcy roundup for the October 2014 term. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome three experts, all law professors. More complete bios were provided you in notice of the call, so I'll just say that we have Professor Thomas Plank, who is the Joel A. Katz Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tennessee College of Law. We also have Professor Zvi Rosen, who is the Visiting Assistant Professor of Law at Hofstra University. And we also have Professor David Skeel, who is the Samuel Arst Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. So I'm going to stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. So I'm going to turn it first to Professor Thomas Plank. The floor is yours.
Yes. The Wellness International Network case involves two issues, whether a bankruptcy court has the constitutional power to adjudicate and enter final judgment on what constitutes property of the bankruptcy estate, and if not, whether the parties may nevertheless consent to such final adjudication by the bankruptcy court and whether that consent may be implied. The court decided the second issue, the issue of consent, in an opinion written by Justice Sotomayor, joined by four other justices, and then also Justice Alito concurred in a separate opinion. Court held that the parties in a bankruptcy case could consent to the final adjudication by a bankruptcy court of an issue of the property of the estate, and that this consent could be implied as long as the consent was knowingly and voluntarily given. Therefore, the court did not reach the issue of the bankruptcy court's adjudicatory power over property of the estate. Justice Roberts dissented, and so did Justice Thomas. Now, Wellness addresses two issues that naturally arise from the Supreme Court's 2011 decision in Stern v. Marshall. In Stern, the Supreme Court held that the bankruptcy court did not have the constitutional authority to enter final judgment on a compulsory counterclaim followed by a debtor against a creditor for tortious interference with a gift from the debtor's husband. The compulsory counterclaim, in the view of the court, was an ordinary common law suit that could only be adjudicated in the federal court system by an Article III judge appointed for life and not by an Article I bankruptcy judge appointed for a 14-year term by the applicable Court of Appeals. In Wellness, the petitioner, Wellness International Network, had obtained a judgment in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas against the respondent Richard Sharif for over $650,000 in 2008. Instead of complying with orders compelling discovery of his assets, however, Sharif filed a bankruptcy petition in the Northern District of Illinois listing Wellness as a creditor along with other family members alleged to be creditors. Wellness was the only person to file a proof of claim. Wellness had learned that Sharif had claimed to own property worth over $5 million in a 2002 loan application to a bank. But in the bankruptcy proceedings, Sharif asserted that he lied on his loan application and that these loan assets were held in a trust of which he was only the trustee. Sharif, however, failed to provide sufficient documentation of this alleged trust and any meaningful information on his assets. In response, Wellness filed an adversary proceeding seeking a determination that Sharif be denied a discharge in bankruptcy and that the alleged trust should be considered Sharif's alter ego and the assets of the alleged trust should be included in Sharif's bankruptcy estate. After failing to respond to discovery again and an explicit warning by the bankruptcy court entered final default judgment for Wellness on all counts. Sharif appealed to the district court, which affirmed, and then Sharif appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. The Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment denying discharge, but reversed the default judgment on property estate. The court held that Wellness's claim that the trust assets should be included in the bankruptcy estate was like the compulsory counterclaim in Stern, and therefore the bankruptcy court did not have the constitutional authority to enter final judgment on such a Stern claim. Further, the Seventh Circuit held that the question of the bankruptcy court's constitutional authority could not be, quote, waived by the parties. Now, this ruling was necessary because by failing to raise Stern until late in the appeals process, Sharif had arguably waived or forfeited his right to object to the bankruptcy court's final adjudication. Both of these issues are significant issues. Issue of consent affects not just bankruptcy cases, but also the role and power of magistrates in federal courts. And, of course, the determination of property of the estate is at the core of every bankruptcy case. However, determining the extent of the bankruptcy court's authority to enter final judgment on what is property of the estate is much more difficult than it appears. In fact, I think it's likely that the difficulty in devising a principal basis for determining where to draw the line on the bankruptcy court's power may have induced the majority of the justices to decide the consent issue. On the surface, the decision on consent seems straightforward, although in practice there may be impediments to a completely voluntary consent. And there's the whole sort of range of sort of strategic kind of issues that are going to come up in this whole area. So this is going to be fascinating to see how this develops. But on the other hand, Justice Roberts' view, the court could lead to erosion of the powers of the judicial branch of the government. And therefore, in his view, the court should have decided what he conceived to be the narrower issue of the bankruptcy court's adjudicatory power over property of the estate. Justice Thomas agreed on the grounds that if the alter ego property of the estate claim in Wellness is a Stern claim, the party's consent cannot empower a non-Article III judge to exercise the judicial power under the Constitution. Now, the majority on consent relied primarily on the 1986 Supreme Court decision on Commodity Futures Trading Commission v. Shore. And because of this precedent, Justice Alito concurred in the result, but not the reasoning. Now, my own view, notwithstanding Shore and what one may think about Shore as a broader separation of powers case, I do think there's actually a historical basis for permitting consent in bankruptcy cases that would be independent of the reasoning in Shore. And I'm planning on writing a law review sort of exploring that whole aspect of it. So the consent issue, seems to be taken care of. And the court, again, relying on Shore, held that allowing bankruptcy courts to decide Stern claims did not, in the words of Shore, quote, impermissibly threaten the institutional integrity of the judicial branch. And that was something that Justice Roberts was concerned about, and he dissented because he thought the decision weakens the constitutional protection of the separation of powers. And therefore, he thought, well, let's decide the narrower case of property of the estate. In this case, the Chief Justice thought this to be an easy question because there was no third party asserting any rights to the trust estate. And in fact, Justice Roberts invoked the court's jurisprudence upholding the powers of referees under the Bankruptcy Act of 1898 to exercise summary jurisdiction over the extent of a debtor's interest in property in the actual constructive possession or control of the bankruptcy trustee when no third party had a substantial interest in the property. In my view, however, this, you know, even deciding the case on this narrow basis would have left just a huge number of open issues on the extent of the bankruptcy court's adjudicatory power. And I think it's actually very difficult to develop a principal basis for determining, you know, when a claim is going to be a Stern claim or not. These two cases sort of represent two ends of the spectrum. In Stern, that's one extreme. First of all, there's no doubt that the debtor's claim for tortious interference with a gift belonged to the debtor It was property of the estate. The claim itself was property of the estate. No issue there. But the question there was, how do you realize on that claim? And the court said, well, you got to do it in an Article III court, or a bankruptcy court can't do it. In Wellness, there was just a bald and unsubstantiated claim by the debtor that he didn't own assets that he had previously claimed to own. But most of your issues involving property estate require the adjudication of the rights of third parties who may or may not be creditors, who have substantial property interests in the property item in question. So, for example, you have a question, was a transfer of assets a true sale or a disguised grant of a security interest where, in fact, the assets, the ownership still remained with the seller? Is a purported lease really a lease, or is it a sale of property and the retention of a security interest? All kinds of cases you can think of that where the difficult property of the state issues and that fall in between the sort of the extreme of both Stern and Wellness. I think it is kind of difficult to draw this line, and I've actually been thinking about this and for a long time, and I haven't come up with anything that's completely satisfactory, but I'm going to try to work on it. Justice Roberts also attempted to distinguish the claim in Wellness from Stern on the grounds that the alter ego claim in Wellness stems not from any independent source of law, but from the bankruptcy itself. And I don't think this reasoning is very helpful, because it is true that the bankruptcy code defines what is property of the estate, but property of the estate just consists of interest of the debtor in property, and that's determined by non-bankruptcy law, not bankruptcy law. So anyway, I think this will continue to be an important issue, and courts are going to be wrestling with this for a good long time. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is Tzvi Rosen. I'm going to be talking about two cases here, both of them Chapter 13 cases, Harris v. Vigalon and Bullard versus High Park Savings Bank. I think most of us are probably familiar with Chapter 13, where the debtor is paying, where you have a wage-earning debtor paying for debts over a usually five-year term. So in Bullard versus Hyde Park Savings Bank, you have a case where the debtor owned a two-unit piece of residential real property in Massachusetts, held a mortgage. Debtor filed for Chapter 13 relief, and basically the property was substantially underwater. Values were between 245 and 285 compared to the mortgage. And Bullard, as the debtor, proposed to pay a plan that would have paid the entire secured claim and to bifurcate it into paying about 5% of the unsecured claim. Hyde Park objected to confirmation. They said that a bifurcated plan like this shouldn't be permitted. And the court agreed with Hyde Park. I mean, it's sort of a lengthy reason why, but the gist of it was that the court held that a plan that proposed to pay the secured portion of the debt over a longer than a five-year term life of the plan is not permissible under 1322, where it's modifying the rights. Basically, Hyde Park was owed this amount of $387,000, and because it was being modified to only pay them between 245 and 285, the court held that it could not go longer than 5 years. Bullard appealed the denial of confirmation to the First Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel. Most of us know what that is also. It's basically a panel of bankruptcy judges that's sitting in lieu of district court to hear appeals of bankruptcy matters. Now, the First Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel once upheld the ruling of a bankruptcy court. The Bankruptcy Appellate Panel, however, ruled that bifurcated plans, like the kind of a debtor was advocating, were not confirmable either way. Now, this is all sort of technical bankruptcy matters in terms of why the plan wouldn't be approvable in terms of a bifurcated plan. The actual case went up before Supreme Court, though, however, is not about whether a plan is appealable in and of itself, because Bullard then filed a notice of appeal to the First Circuit of the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel's ruling. And the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel denied the motion to certify the appeal. They said that the order denying confirmation was not a final order, And then the First Circuit ordered briefing on both the merits question in terms of whether a plan was confirmable and the jurisdictional question of whether or not, in fact, the appeal is a final order. The First Circuit ended up holding that confirmation is not a proceeding within the meaning of 28 U.S.C. 158, and therefore the decision, and therefore that decision denying confirmation and decision of bankruptcy appellate panel affirming the denial of confirmation, that neither one is a final order, and accordingly that there is no appeal as of right to the First Circuit. And this interesting thing where if Bullard had pursued an interlocutory appeal either directly to the First Circuit or an interlocutory appeal to the district court, that in turn could be certified to the First Circuit. However, the bankruptcy appellate panel decision could not be appealed to the First Circuit because it's not a final order and there was no mechanism for going from the appellate panel to the First Circuit. So the actual question for the Supreme Court is whether or not this was a final order and appealable as of right. And the court notes there's not really a excessive governing precedent, and you have these competing concerns of fairness on one hand, judicial efficiency on the other hand. And one thing that came up a lot at argument was the fact that if a plan had been confirmed, there would be an appeal as of right. And on the other hand, if a plan was denied and dismissed without the right to modify, then the debtor could appeal as of right. And so the question becomes, if you have a denial of a plan, but you have the right to amend the plan, whether that should also be appealable or whether because you have all these types of contested matters, and court notes that Collier provides a list of 47 types of contested matters, surely not all of these are appealable of right as final orders. You had another interesting thing where both the Office of United States Trustee and Bank of America submitted amicus briefs on behalf of Bullard, saying the denial of a plan should be appealable as of right. In the end, you had a fairly short unanimous opinion from Chief Justice Roberts saying that an order denying confirmation of a plan is not appealable as of right. And the court does look at the statute somewhat, but basically noting that the question of what is a core proceeding that is not defined by the statute, and it looks mostly at concerns of judicial efficiency and saying, all right, you have this long list of contested matters, and you know this is ultimately not the sort of thing which is the final order. And the court held that an order denying confirmation of plan is not a final order. I think the upshot for practitioners is definitely be mindful of your appellate strategy going forward. If you have a denial of dismissal, you have different possible avenues for appeal, and the fact that different jurisdictions use a bankruptcy appellate panel differently, I think you have to be mindful of how to pursue the appeal and what venues you choose. The other case I'm talking about is Harris v. Vigalon. And this is in some ways a simpler case. This addresses what happens when you have a Chapter 13 plan, it's confirmed, and then things go wrong. Harris was behind in his payments to Chase Manhattan Bank. He filed for Chapter 13 relief in order to avoid foreclosure. And you had a situation where the plan was confirmed and he was going to pay, and Harris was going to pay Chase directly, and then he paid a Chapter 13 trustee out of his paycheck to pay off the accumulated payments owed to Chase along with an additional secured creditor. So future payments were being made directly to Chase, the secured creditor, and a Chapter 13 trustee was being paid out of Harris's paycheck to pay off the accumulated amount of unpaid payments on a mortgage before a petition. So an unsecured creditor would receive almost nothing under the plan. However, Harris once again fell behind on his direct payments, and Chase saw it and was eventually granted relief from a stay, and they had freedom to foreclose. There was about a year of negotiation between Harris and Chase where he tried to work out some sort of deal where he'd be able to keep his house. And this whole time, his Chapter 13 trustee was continually paid through a direct payment out of his paycheck while this negotiation was going on. Finally, Chase moved to foreclose, and Harris moved to convert the case to Chapter 7. When Harris moved to convert to Chapter 7, because there had been a year period of negotiation between Harris and Chase, the Chapter 13 trustee had about $5,000 in undistributed funds, and Harris had paid out. Chapter 13 trustee then used these funds to pay his administrative fees, including U.S. trustee and Chapter 13 trustee fee, and then paid the remnant of these amounts to the other secured creditors and remaining unsecured creditors who otherwise would have received nothing. Now, Harris moved to be refunded the monies, and a bankruptcy court agreed, and the court affirmed. The Eighth Circuit and Rehan reversed and held the money did not need to be refunded. So you had a situation. Now, Chapter 7 bankruptcy is more, most of us know, straight liquidation. Had Harris filed Chapter 7 in the first place, he would not owe any of his continuing wages or creditors. So the question before the courts at every stage was whether these funds should be used to pay debts when refunded, returned to the creditor. And so here we have the statutory provision on point. 348F of Bankruptcy Code says that undistributed funds not become part of Chapter 7 estate on conversion unless the conversion to Chapter 7 was done in bad faith. So Bankruptcy Code also makes it clear the services of Chapter 13 trustee terminate at confirmation. And so accordingly, you had a short unanimous opinion saying that once a trustee's appointment was terminated, the only thing the trustee can do is return the funds to the debtor. The trustee has no right, has no power to do anything else with money beyond that because the appointment was terminated immediately. And there were concerns in this opinion as to whether a debtor could do some sort of gamesmanship and could file and then have the money sort of rack up and not be attached upon and get a windfall confirmation. This was mostly shooed away because it was the trustee's failure to distribute the funds in part. And the unique circumstances of the case, where there was only one large secured creditor, was the reason that they hadn't been paid out. So accordingly, the court said that they were not concerned about possible gamesmanship of the system and that any overages that are held by the Chapter 13 trustee that are not distributed to creditors are returned to what is now Chapter 7 debtor on confirmation. Thank you.
Okay, this is David Skeel, and I will be concluding our overview part of the call by talking about Bank of America versus Caulquette, which was a consumer debtor Chapter 7 case. The question in Caulquette is what happens in bankruptcy if there are two liens on the same property, and the property isn't worth enough even to pay off the first of those two liens, the claim that's secured by the first of the two liens. And in particular, in this situation where the first lien is partially underwater, the second lien is completely underwater, can the second lien be stripped off? The lower court in the Caulquette case and in a companion case and in a series of cases in the same circuit had said, yes, the second lien can be stripped off. Other courts had said no, they could not, and that is the issue that the Supreme Court was resolving. So to give it a little bit more content for folks who might not be bankruptcy nerds, let me just give an illustration of what's going on in the case. Suppose that the debtor owes $1,000 to the first of two banks, to First Bank, and has given a tractor as collateral for repayment of that loan, and the tractor is worth $700. So there is a $1,000 first claim, collateral is worth $700. The debtor also owes $500 to Second Bank and has given Second Bank a lien on the same collateral. If those are the facts, there is enough value to support part of First Bank's claim, $700 of the $1,000. There's no value in the collateral in the tractor, in my example, to support any of Second Bank's claim. And the question is, can the debtor, under these circumstances, strip off that second lien and treat Second Bank as if Second Bank doesn't have a lien at all? Now, why does this matter? There are a variety of reasons why this could be important. Probably the most obvious one is if a debtor is underwater on whatever the collateral is, it's often a home, as in the Calcutta case itself, they file for Chapter 7, they may want to keep their home by renegotiating the terms of their mortgage with the first bank and promising to pay first bank back, say, something between $700 and $1,000. If they also have this lien held by second bank and they can't do anything about that bank, they're formally required to pay that second bank's lien in full unless the second bank agrees to something else, it's going to make it a lot harder to renegotiate a deal so that the debtor can end up keeping the house. So that's a practical reason why this matters. Again, the bottom line question in Calcutta is simply, if a second lien is completely underwater, if there is no value to support it, can it be stripped out, stripped off? And what the Supreme Court said in what was a surprise to many of us, and particularly was a surprise to people who listened to the oral arguments, was no, that second lien cannot be stripped off. To explain how we got there and to some extent why this is a surprising result, I need to take a step back for a minute and provide a little bit of the background of the case. So the statutory provision that was at issue in the case says a couple of different things. It's Section 506 of the Bankruptcy Code. 506A says that if a claim is underwater, if a claim that's secured by collateral that's worth less than the amount of the claim, that claim should be treated as partially secure, as a secured claim to the extent of the value of the collateral, and as unsecured for the remainder. So in my example, the $700 value of the collateral, that would be a secured claim, according to 506A. The $300 uncollateralized part would be treated as an unsecured claim. This is all uncontroversial. It's in Section 506A of the Bankruptcy Code. Another subsection in that same section, 506D, seems to say that with respect to the unsecured portion, the $300 in my illustration, the lien gets stripped off, that the lien is void. If you just read the statute and what it says. In 1992, however, the Supreme Court decided a case called Doosnip, where the court said that's not what 506D means at all. Even if a lien creditor, a secured creditor, is under collateralized, the lien cannot be stripped off. It stays there until the property is sold or something happens with the property. The Doosnip decision seemed to have been driven by a concern that allowing the secured creditor's lien to be stripped down would give a windfall to the debtor on the facts of that particular case. To prevent the windfall, or for whatever other reason, the Supreme Court construed the bankruptcy code in a way that's very, very hard to square with the language. But what the Supreme Court said is you can never strip down a lien on collateral, even if that lien is under collateralized or is underwater. What courts have been wrestling with in recent years after Doosnip is just how far Doosnip should be taken, just how far it goes. And the particular issue that they have been worrying about is the issue of Calcutta. What happens where the first lien is underwater, so the collateral is not worth enough to pay off the first lien, and there is a second lien that is completely underwater, that looks like it's not going to get anything on account of its lien? In that situation, the question arose in the lower courts, can that second lien at least be struck, be stripped off, despite what Doosnip says, at least about first liens. So coming to the Supreme Court, this looked like a pretty good case for the debtor, for Caucat. For this reason, the conservative justices, or a number of the conservative justices on the court, don't like the Doosnip opinion. The Doosnip opinion seems to ignore the literal language of the bankruptcy code. In Doosnip itself, Justice Scalia, who was one of the few justices who was around in 1992 and was involved in the case, Justice Scalia had ridiculed what the majority did, criticizing what he called its subsection by subsection interpretation of the bankruptcy code. The Doosnip court interpreted secured claim as meaning one thing in the beginning of section 506 and something completely different in the end of subsection 6. So the conservatives were thought to be quite willing to side with Caucat and maybe even to overrule Doosnip. The liberal justices, on the other hand, were expected to be sympathetic to this debtor who had a home that he wanted to keep. It's underwater. There is a second lien on it. The second lien has no value attached to it at all. The debtor seemed like a pretty sympathetic debtor from the perspective of the liberal justices. So there was a fairly widespread expectation that Caucat would at the least win, that the Supreme Court would say that second lien could be stripped off, and at most that the Supreme Court might go ahead and overrule Doosnip altogether. So what happens in the Supreme Court? What we get is a 9-0 ruling against Caucat in, as V was saying with Harris, a similarly short opinion. It's a 7-page opinion with no dissent. The only murmur of dissent is that three of the justices, Kennedy, Breyer, and Sotomayor, didn't sign on to a footnote, the only footnote in the opinion, which talked about how much Doosnip has been criticized. But 9-0 decision, Caucat loses. Why does Caucat lose in a case that looks pretty strong, both in terms of the law and in terms of the equities of the case? Well, what the Supreme Court suggested, and it was an opinion by Justice Thomas, is that the key fact was that the lawyers for Caucat did not ask the Supreme Court to overrule Doosnip. And they specifically said they weren't asking for an overruling of Doosnip. All they were asking for is that the court say, even if Doosnip is still good law, it doesn't extend to completely underwater second liens. What the Supreme Court said is, if we adopt that position, we're once again not giving meaning to what the statute says. What you're asking us to do is to adopt another non-literal reading of Section 506. We're not willing to do that. And so the court said, since you didn't ask us to overrule Doosnip, or at least that's the way I'm reading what the court said, we're going to stick to what Doosnip says, and Doosnip applies to your case, and the second lien cannot be stripped off. My guess is that if another case comes along and the petitioner can get the Supreme Court to take it, Doosnip may be overruled. But at this point, liens are pretty well protected in bankruptcy. That's all I have.
All right. Well, thank you to each of our experts for an excellent presentation. Let's now move. We've got some time for questions, so we'll open the floor to questions in a moment. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. We're actually having some technical difficulties with the system, so if everyone will hold on just a second, we can see if we can get this working. Here we are. This should be it. So I apologize for the delay, but again, if you have a question that you'd like to ask of one of our experts about any of the cases that were decided, press star and then the pound key. And it looks like we did have our first question on the line.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name's Kirk Kennedy, and I'm a kind of out in the trenches here, a bankruptcy practitioner. And I have a comment and a question. One, on the jurisdiction case, it'd be nice to see the court or Congress kind of clean up all these jurisdictional games and uncertainties. It's very costly. People play games with it. It doesn't contribute to success on the merits, and it's really inefficient, and they need to do something about that. So somebody does. That's my comment to the first case. A friend of mine argued the did you guys discuss the attorneys, the Osarco case and the shifting attorneys fees case? I got on a few minutes late.
We actually did not. We talked about the fact that we weren't discussing it, and I'm not sure how it fell through the cracks. But
well, if anyone has any comments on that, I'd like to hear that. And then finally, I am working on a case right now that is going to work its way up into, I believe, could very likely. You know, you kind of see how these things germinate down at the trial court level, but. Does the panel think that a Chapter 11, an interpretation of a Chapter 11, plan provision? I got to believe that there haven't been many cases on that, and that would be a good area to fertile ground for the court to at least take an interest in it. You know, as long as it's financially significant and an important. You know, it's written about. Obviously, there's some confusion in the circuit, so I'd be interested in whether you think a Chapter 11 plan provision might. Be able to work its way up the interpretation of that.
Anybody want to respond?
Well, sorry, go ahead.
Let me just jump in and say I think that it all really depends on what the plan provision is. One area that I think, and I've written about and have against are the non-debtor waiver of claims against non-debtors. If our plan contains that, and then the extent to which you can force someone who doesn't voluntarily accept the plan still. Have a waiver of their claims against non-debtors be effective, so that would be the kind of a provision I would love to see the court take, but I have no idea to what extent they might actually do something like that.
This is Tzvi Rosen. On the Baker Botts case, I think it's an interesting case, but really cuts to the question to a degree. You have a question of whether you're going to. How strictly you're cutting the statute in terms of what's for the benefit of the estate or not. There is sort of a sense that, well, on one hand, you don't want to expand the fact that each party pays her own fees beyond sort of the straight and narrow definition of it. On the other hand, you do wonder that if it's going to cost $5 million to defend the attorney's fees, then you do get into questions of, well, isn't it sort of for benefit of the estate, and especially in terms of the unique nature of that case, in terms of Baker Botts and co-counsel getting a giant recovery for the debtor?
All right. Well, we have one more question pending, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to come on and ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Here we go.
Thank you. My name is Shmuel Klein. I'm also a bankruptcy attorney, primarily for consumers. And I had a question on Harris, and that it dealt primarily with cases that got converted and trustees having to pay the monies back to the debtors directly. What about when a case is dismissed? Trustees are likewise, their duties are completed when a case is dismissed, and funds that have not been distributed should be also turned back to the debtors, or should they be distributed pursuant to a plan? That's one question. The other question is, in 13s, in stripping seconds, everybody's pretty much, at least in my district, continue to use the Pond case to continue to state that 13s allow seconds to be stripped, and I think the court kind of tiptoed around that and left that alone, and I just wanted to see if the panel agreed.
Well, this is Tavir Rosen again. On Harris, I have to look again at the opinion, but my read of it is, you know, that it's basically saying that when the trustee's appointment is terminated, the trustee's appointment is terminated, and there's nothing more to do. But I do think the rationale is somewhat specific to conversion as opposed to dismissal. So I don't think that I would view it as dispositive in that point, but it does seem to indicate pretty strongly that when a trustee's appointment is terminated, it's terminated, and that's the end of it. On Pond, I think you're right. I think that the court was not interested in dealing, was very careful to tiptoe around that.
Thank you.
This is Tom Plank. On this question of 7 versus 13 and Duznip, I think the if you're going to follow the logic of Duznip, then it should apply to 13, unless I'm not an expert in 13, so I don't know. Maybe there's something different about it. But it would seem to me that Duznip should apply in 13. No real reason why it shouldn't, other than the fact that it's a bad decision. And you might say, well, if you got a bad decision in Chapter 7, we're not going to extend that bad decision to Chapter 13. So that perhaps explains the silence of the court and consistent with what David was thinking about or expressed in terms of why did the court come out the way it did.
Well, this is David Skeel. Just to jump in on that, I agree completely. The argument that Duznip might not apply in 11 and 13 that I've seen and that was in the briefing for Calcat is an argument that the confirmation provisions in both 11 and 13 have the effect of essentially stripping down an under-collateralized secured claims. Claimants lien. And so the argument is there are special rules in Chapter 11 and Chapter 13. I don't actually find that completely compelling. It seems pretty clear to me that the confirmation provisions in Chapter 11 and Chapter 13 were assuming that the liens had been stripped down. And it's not obvious to me why Duznip wouldn't apply all the way through. But that's not what the lower courts have done on the whole. It's mostly been applied just in Chapter 7.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan. I just want to let the audience know that our lines are open if you have a question. And then one quick programming note that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow, Tuesday, July 28th at 2 p.m. Eastern, sponsored by our Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group on a case called Clay v. United States, pending in the 11th Circuit on criminalizing reasonable interpretations of regulatory schemes. So that is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern time. On Tuesday, July 28th. It looks like we did have one more question jump on, so we can go right to that now.
This is Mark Scarberry. I teach at Pepperdine, and it's great to hear all of you. It's a wonderful program. In terms of expanding Duznip to Chapter 13, I've been under the impression that the court in Duznip relied to some extent on history, that you couldn't strip liens outside of a plan sort of proceeding, and 13 involves a plan. The other thing it seems to me is in 13 and 11, both, you have authority to modify an unsecured claim, and to the extent we use 506 to separate the secured from the unsecured claim, then you can modify the unsecured claim to eliminate the lien. So that's the way I've looked at it. And I think that justifies what the lower courts have done.
This is David Skeel. Hi, Mark. It's nice to hear your voice, even though it's 3,000 miles away, I assume. and I'm not surprised to hear that take, which does strike me as a completely plausible reading of 11 and 13 and how they differ from Chapter 7 with respect to DUSNIP, it is consistent with what the lawyers representing Bank of America, the arguments they made in Call-Cat. I still am of the view that that DUSNIP was a mistake, that it is misreading Section 506. But those arguments about 11 and 13 do seem to me to limit the damage of DUSNIP. I think DUSNIP ought to be overruled, but those are plausible distinctions between Chapter 7, which is what was at issue in Call-Cat, and Chapter 11 and Chapter 13.
Good to hear your voice too, David. It seems to me that the only real basis for DUSNIP was the problem that effectively any other decision would have allowed redemption beyond the scope of the redemption provision in Chapter 7. But I've raised that, and people have said it's a red herring, so I could be wrong.
I agree with you on that. You know, and it was, as we all know, at least those of us who are bankruptcy nerds know, it was a very strange factual context. But you've persuaded me.
All right, well, looks like we had one more question jump on the line, and we've got time to go to it, so we'll get right to that now, and then we probably will have time for another question or two after that. So if you'd like to ask a question and get in the queue, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Todd Brown from Buffalo. I was just, I guess I had a question about wellness and combined with Arkansas, just to get your sense of how likely is it now that we're starting to see some of the cases that came up in the immediate aftermath of Stern, those cases kind of work their way out, and given the ruling in Arkansas and the ruling in wellness, how likely do you think it is that we're going to see the kinds of questions concerning the what the core of the bankruptcy power is make it up to the court? And the other question I had is about Bank of America, and I've had this discussion with several practitioners concerning the footnote and the fact that three justices refused to join the footnote, six others did, and how much of a signal that may or may not be that the justices are in fact likely to take up a case that challenges DUSNIP in the future. Can we really read those tea leaves to say that, or is there something else going on with that? Thanks.
So this is David's. Oh, you want to let me go first, Tom, and I'll because I have the footnote. The footnote, the small part. This is David Skeel. I'll address the last part first. So the footnote is the footnote where Justices Kennedy, Breyer, and Sotomayor join the entire Call-Cat opinion, except for its footnote saying that DUSNIP has been heavily criticized. It's really hard to know what that footnote means. I mean, one reading of it might be that they wouldn't be willing to overrule DUSNIP. A more speculative reading of it that I heard about the time the opinion came out was that maybe these justices were thinking about other statutory interpretation cases, such as the healthcare case, where the majority sort of fixed the statute by reading some language out of it or reinterpreting the literal language of the statute. And it may have been that these justices were thinking about that. They all three of these justices joined the majority in the healthcare opinion. So it's really hard to know what that footnote means, but it also does seem like there may be a majority for overruling DUSNIP. So Tom, sorry to jump in on you.
No, that's fine. Yeah, on the wellness thing and the consent thing, I think there's going to be a lot of, as I understand it, and I am not a bankruptcy practitioner. I got into bankruptcy from the structured financial and commercial finance side. But my understanding is, just thinking about the practicality of when you're litigating cases in front of bankruptcy judges, and do you want to be, telling the judge, well, we don't want you to hear this case, Your Honor, when you have a lot of other, have other issues before that judge in this case, and you also have a lot of other cases in front of the bankruptcy judge, versus you're still going to have, I think, circumstances where people are going to figure that I've got a much better shot in the district court than I would have in the bankruptcy court. So I think there's going to be a good, fair amount of, litigation, contention, argument, and people are going to have to sort of feel their way. And, of course, this only really, if you don't have consent, this only deals with property of the estate, but you also have fraudulent transfer. That's a big deal. And there seems to be harder basis for saying, well, maybe the bankruptcy court's got the ability to adjudicate a fraudulent transfer claim, and it may very well be that fraudulent transfer claims are going to have to be heard in the district court and not the, unless people consent. And it may very well be that the people who are representing those being sued in fraudulent transfer claims have no real sort of institutional pressure to consent. So I think these issues are going to, keep coming, and it's going to take a while to percolate through the system.
This is Spheros, and I just add to that I think also denial of discharge in some cases, you might have some interesting I can fully imagine a case going forward that involves a denial of discharge claim and question of whether you have to hear it in district court in certain cases.
Well, we have a couple minutes left, so let's go ahead and do a last call for questions. Again, if you'd like to jump on, press star and the pound key. All right, looks like we do have one more question on the line.
This is Shmuel Klein again. I just want to say that as far as a quick resolution and a preferred venue for quickly resolving issues, the consent case was a breath of fresh air. To be involved in a district court case that is going to be put behind criminal cases that overwhelm district courts, and the option of going before a bankruptcy court that can make a decision in 2 weeks or 30 days is far preferable if counsel can agree to have the bankruptcy court decide the issue.
Anyone care to comment on that?
Well, this is Tom Plank. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. In fact, I think there is a historical justification, and I've written about this, and I wrote a law review article. Actually, Justice Thomas cited my law review article on sort of the historical background of bankruptcy adjudication, and there's a good bit of I think justification for bankruptcy judges, even though they're not Article III judges, being able to enter final judgment on a lot of issues. The only problem, of course, is that I think it's difficult to draw the line. So when you may have people who it is not in their interest to have this issue resolved quickly, and they would prefer to be in district court. So each case is going to be different. It'll be fun to see. Give me something to write about for a good long time, I hope.
Any final thoughts, Professor Rosen or Professor Skeel?
This is David Skeel. Not for me. I think this has been, for me at least, very, very helpful and very interesting. And it has been an unusually bankruptcy-heavy Supreme Court term. So it was kind of fun to be a bankruptcy scholar this term.
Yeah, this is Tzvi Rosen. The one interesting thing you have this term, and it goes back to last term beyond, is how the Office of the U.S. Trustee keeps striking out for the Supreme Court. It used to be gospel that if they just decided a case, it was pretty much a slam dunk, and they've just lost repeatedly in these cases these days. It's kind of interesting.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all three professors for joining us today for an excellent presentations and an excellent discussion. Thank you to the audience for joining us. Just a reminder that if you missed any part of this call or would like to re-listen to it, usually within 24 to 48 hours, we will post the recording of this call on our website as a podcast at fedsoc.org, so you can re-listen to this or any of our previous Teleform conference calls at any time. So until tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern for our criminal law and procedure Teleform conference call, we're adjourned. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.